Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're going on a fascinating journey. We're going to explore the concept of structure in biblical books.
Ooh, sounds intriguing.
It is. And to help us with this, we'll be drawing insights from a lecture on inductive Bible study. Now, this isn't just about the usual like chapters and verses.
So there's more.
Way more. We're talking about uncovering the hidden architecture of these books, the blueprints that shape their meaning.
I'm getting excited already.
I know, right? Get ready, because we're going to uncover some serious aha moments along the way.
Can't wait.
Okay, so let's dive right in. The lecture starts by talking about something called linear structure.
Linear structure, huh?
Yep. When I hear that, I kind of picture like building blocks, you know, main units and subunits within a book, all fitting together.
Ah, I see. Like the book has its own unique layout.
Exactly. It's all about how those units are arranged. And, you know, how that arrangement impacts our understanding.
Right, because it's not just a random jumble of thoughts.
Precisely. And the lecture says the key to identifying these building blocks, those units, is recognizing something called shifts in emphasis.
Shifts in emphasis. So, like, changes in what the author is focusing on.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not like a particular theme disappears entirely. It's more like the author is strategically shifting the spotlight.
Yeah. Okay, so they're highlighting different aspects at different times.
Exactly. Like, let's say the author might be focusing on judgment in one section, but then in the next, they shift the focus to maybe hope and restoration.
Got it. So it's kind of like watching a play, right, where the stage lights illuminate different parts of the set.
That's a fantastic analogy. It draws our attention to specific characters and actions.
And in this case, the author is the director, guiding our attention through the text.
Spot on. And you know what? The lecture actually uses a really great example of this. It talks about the book of Amos.
Oh, Amos. That's a powerful book.
Right. So can you walk us through how this shift in emphasis thing plays out in Amos?
Sure. So Amos is a really cool example because it shows this shift super clearly. The book starts off focusing on God's judgment. But it's judgment against the surrounding nations, not Israel itself.
Okay, so God's judgment is the initial focus.
Yep. But as you move through the chapters, you start to see this really interesting pattern emerging. The writer, they bring each nation geographically closer and closer to Israel.
Closer and closer.
Yeah, it's like they're creating this sense of anticipation and maybe even a bit of dread.
Ooh, I like that. Like watching a storm cloud approaching on the horizon. You know it's coming, but you're not sure when it's going to hit.
Exactly. And then, bam, the focus shifts squarely onto Israel.
So the placement of these units, these building blocks, it's intentional. It's not just random, right?
Absolutely not. Placement is key. The author is totally using the order of events and ideas to shape how the reader experiences the text.
You know, it's a bit like setting up dominoes.
Dominoes.
Yeah, you know, each one has to fall in the right sequence to get the desired effect. Otherwise, the whole thing falls apart.
I love that analogy. It really highlights how the arrangement of the text contributes to its overall impact.
And, you know, I think this whole concept of structure adds like a whole new dimension to how we understand the Bible.
Totally agree. It's not just about what the text says. It's also about how it says it.
Exactly. The way it's structured is a crucial part of the message.
It's like appreciating a piece of music, right?
Right.
You can hear the individual notes, but it's the melody, the harmony, the rhythm, the structure that really brings it to life.
So true. And the lecture also mentions something called primacy and subsequency. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. Primacy and subsequency, they just refer to the order in which things appear in the text.
Okay, so what comes first and what follows?
Right. What comes first, primacy, kind of lays the groundwork for what follows, subsequency.
I get it. It's like building a house, right? You need a strong foundation before you can add the walls and roof.
Perfect example. And the same principle applies to writing. The author is deliberately choosing what to present first in order to set the stage for everything that comes after.
So what comes first creates context and meaning for everything that follows. This makes me think about how a good storyteller uses foreshadowing or like how a comedian structures a joke to get the biggest laugh.
Absolutely. Authors use these techniques all the time, whether they're writing a novel, a screenplay, or, you know, even a biblical book. It's all about using structure to create a specific effect on the reader or listener.
This is already blowing my mind, but the lecture hints that we can go even deeper beyond just these basic building blocks. Is that where those aha moments you mentioned come in?
Oh, absolutely. This is where things get really interesting. We're going to move beyond simply identifying the units of a text. We're going to start exploring the relationships between them.
Ooh, sound exciting. Like we're going to uncover hidden connections.
Exactly. And this is where we'll really see the author's brilliance, the subtle ways they use structure to shape meaning and impact.
Okay, I am officially hooked. Where do we start?
Well, the lecture introduces this concept called primary structural relationships.
Primary structural relationships. Okay, I'm listening.
Think of these like the big levers an author uses. You know, they use these to control the flow and impact of their work.
So these relationships, are they like the underlying principles, like the principles that govern how the different parts of a book are connected?
Yes, exactly. And one of the most common of these primary structural relationships is recurrence.
Recurrence. That sounds kind of familiar.
Well, recurrence is basically about repetition, but it's not just any repetition. It's the deliberate use of repetition to emphasize key themes and ideas.
Ah, okay. So it's not just random. It's intentional.
Exactly. Think of it like a composer using a recurring musical theme. You know, they use it to create a sense of unity and cohesion in a symphony.
Got it. It's like a thread that ties the whole piece together.
Perfect analogy. Mm. So it's not just about words or phrases being repeated. It's about how that repetition points to something important, something the author wants us to pay attention to.
So it's about the meaning behind the repetition.
Exactly. A word might be repeated lots of times in a text, but if it's not connected to a key theme or idea, it's not really recurrence in the structural sense.
Right. It's like hearing a bird chirping outside your window. It's a repetitive sound, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything, right? It doesn't have a purpose in, like, the bigger picture of your day.
Exactly. Recurrence is about those intentional repetitions that highlight what's truly important in the text.
It's like the author saying, hey, pay attention to this. This is crucial to understanding my message.
That's a great way to put it. It's like they're highlighting certain passages with a giant neon sign.
So can you give us some examples of recurrence in the Bible? I'm curious to see how this plays out in practice.
Sure. One example the lecture mentions is the word witness in the book of Acts.
Witness. Okay.
Yeah. So this word pops up again and again throughout the book, and it emphasizes the central role of witnessing in the early church's mission.
Interesting. So it's not just a coincidence that the word appears so often.
Nope, not at all. It's a deliberate structural element. It underscores the book's main theme.
So it's not just about those individual stories of the apostles. It's about this bigger theme of spreading the gospel to the whole world.
That's right. And the repetition of witness helps us see those individual stories as part of a larger narrative.
I see. It helps us connect the dots, so to speak.
Exactly. It helps us see how those individual stories contribute to God's plan to redeem the world.
That's really insightful. It makes me want to go back and reread Acts, paying attention to how that word shapes the meaning of the entire book.
I highly recommend it. You'd be surprised what you might discover when you start noticing these structural elements.
I bet. It's like having a secret decoder ring that unlocks a whole new level of meaning. Okay, so we've got recurrence, this idea of intentional repetition to highlight key themes. What other primary structural relationships should we be on the lookout for?
Well, the lecture also talks about contrast, comparison, and climax.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are some big ones. These are all about how different sections of a book relate to each other, not just what's contained within them.
Okay, I think I'm following.
So first up, contrast. Contrast is about highlighting differences, like, you know, putting darkness and light side by side.
Right. It makes each one stand out more.
Exactly. It makes each one more vivid. And the book of Amos, which we were just talking about, uses contrast brilliantly.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, you have these stark pronouncements of, like, judgment and doom. But then, woven throughout, you get these glimpses of hope and ultimate restoration.
It's like the author is taking us on a roller coaster ride, you know, plunging us into despair and then lifting us up with hope.
That's a great way to put it. That contrast really makes both messages more powerful.
It's like a painter using contrasting colors, you know, to create a more dynamic and vibrant image.
Exactly. And then we have comparison. Comparison focuses on similarities.
Okay, so contrast is about differences. Comparison is about similarities. Got
right. And a really good example of comparison is Philippians.
Philippians.
Yeah, so in Philippians, Paul uses role models, you know, to encourage his readers.
Ah, I see. He's showing them what to do by pointing to examples.
Yeah, and it's not just a list of rules like do this and don't do that. It's more like an invitation. An invitation to imitate the lives of people who have followed Christ.
So it's less about abstract principles and more about showing what a life of faith actually looks like, you know, in action.
Exactly. It's like saying, hey, don't just try to be good.
Right?
Try to be like this person.
Right, someone who embodies goodness, that makes it so much more relatable.
Exactly. It makes the message much more inspiring. And then we have climax.
Climax?
Yeah, climax is all about building to a peak, you know, creating that sense of anticipation and then resolution. It's that moment in a story where everything comes together.
Ah, the point of highest tension.
Yes. And this makes me think of the Gospels.
Oh, the Gospels. How so?
Well, you know, they all tell the same basic story, right? But each one builds to a slightly different climax.
I never really thought about it that way.
Right. It's really fascinating. Like, Mark emphasizes the cross. Matthew highlights the resurrection and the Great Commission. Luke focuses on the ascension. And John, it all culminates with the purpose of believing in Jesus.
Wow. So each climax reveals something unique about the author's purpose.
Exactly. It's like each gospel is a facet of a diamond reflecting a different color of light.
That's beautiful. They're all connected, but each one shines in its own unique way.
Beautifully put. Okay, so we've got recurrence, contrast, comparison, and climax.
Wow, we've covered a lot of ground. Are there any other primary structural relationships we should know about?
Yes, there are two more that are particularly interesting. We have cruciality and then particularization and generalization.
Cruciality. Okay, that one sounds intense.
It is. Cruciality is all about a turning point, a pivotal moment of decision or action that completely changes everything that follows.
Oh, this sounds dramatic. Like a plot twist in a movie? That moment where you're on the edge of your seat?
You got it. And the lecture actually highlights a great example of this in the Bible.
Okay, which book?
The book of Esther.
Esther. That whole story is full of twists and turns.
Right. So you have this mounting tension as Haman is plotting to destroy the Jews. Everything seems hopeless. And then Esther steps onto the scene.
Esther, the queen.
Yes. She risks her own life to save her people.
That's right. And that moment where she reveals her identity to the king and pleads for her people, that's got to be the cruciality.
Exactly. It's the moment that completely reverses the course of the story.
It's like that famous quote, "For such a time as this," you know, Esther's courage and her actions, they totally shifted the balance of power.
Yeah.
And like changed history for her people.
It's such a powerful reminder. You know, even in the darkest times, a single act of courage can make all the difference.
So true. And it also underscores those deeper themes of the book, you know, like God's providence and the resilience of his people.
Absolutely. Okay, so cruciality check. That leaves us with particularization and generalization.
Those sound a little more technical.
They are a bit, yeah. But stick with me. These are all about zooming in and out, you know, shifting the lens through which we view the text.
Okay, I'm listening.
So particularization, it starts broad and then gets specific. Generalization does the reverse. It starts specific and then broadens out.
Got it. So it's like using a camera. You know, first you capture a wide shot of the landscape, and then you zoom in on a particular detail that catches your eye.
That's a great way to visualize it. So the author is controlling the scope of our vision, so to speak.
And directing our attention to what's most important at any given moment.
Exactly. And these techniques show up all over the Bible.
Oh, I bet they do. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. So Genesis, for instance, is full of both particularization and generalization. It starts by talking about the whole earth, right? Mm. And then it gradually narrows the focus down to the land of Canaan.
Okay, so it's getting more specific.
Right. And then even more specifically, it zeroes in on a particular family, Abraham and his descendants.
So that's both geographical and biographical particularization at work.
You got it. Yeah. It's like watching a map unfold.
Yeah.
Each layer reveals more and more detail.
And the author is guiding us, leading us to those specific people and places that will be important in God's plan.
That's a great way to put it. And then we have generalization, which does the opposite. It starts specific and then broadens out. And a great example of this is Hebrews.
The Hebrews.
Right. At first, it might seem like Hebrews is just this really deep dive into theology.
Which it is, kinda.
Right. But as you get to the end of the book, the author kind of zooms out and you see that the broader purpose is to encourage believers to persevere in their faith.
So it starts with those theological foundations, the details, and then it expands to show the practical implications, the call to action.
You nailed it. It's like building a bridge from theory to practice.
Showing us how those theological truths should shape our lives.
Exactly. And understanding the zoom in and zoom out effect, it helps us connect the dots, you know, connect those small details to the big picture of the book's message.
It's like looking at a tapestry. You know, you can appreciate the individual threads, but it's the overall design, the way all those threads are woven together, that creates the masterpiece.
Beautifully said. And, you know, We've barely scratched the surface here.
I know, this is blowing my mind. It's like we're seeing the Bible with fresh eyes, discovering all these hidden depths.
There's always more to explore, more layers to uncover.
I'm ready for more.
And speaking of layers, we still need to talk more about particularization. There's actually more to it than meets the eye.
All right, we're back, ready for the final stretch of our deep dive into biblical structure.
Let's do it.
I'm still processing everything we've talked about so far. Recurrence, contrast, cruciality. It's like mind-blowing stuff. And we left off on particularization, right? There was more to unpack there.
Yes, exactly. We talked about geographical and biographical particularization. You know, those zoom-in effects on places and people. But there are actually a few other types that the lecture highlights.
Ooh, even more. Okay, lay it on me. I'm ready to have my mind expanded.
So there's something called identificational particularization.
Identificational, okay.
Yeah, it's kind of like the author is giving us a heading, you know, or a title that sets the stage for the whole book, like right from the start.
Oh, I see. So it's like a signpost, pointing us in the right direction, giving us a clue as to what the book is all about.
Exactly. The lecture uses the book of Nahum as an example.
Nahum, okay.
Right, so it starts with an oracle concerning Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum of Elkosh.
Okay, so right away, we know this book is going to be about Nineveh. And it's about a vision, right? The author's not messing around.
Exactly. And that emphasis on vision, it suggests that we should be paying attention to the imagery and the symbolism throughout the book.
Ah, I see. It's like there's a deeper layer of meaning there, beyond just the literal event.
You got it. The author is signaling to us that there's more to uncover.
That's so cool. It makes me wonder how often I've just skimmed over those opening verses, you know, without really thinking about what they're trying to tell us.
It happens to the best of us. But once you start noticing these structural elements, you realize how much they add to our understanding. It's like the author is giving us a treasure map, and we just need to follow the clues.
I love that analogy. So any other examples of this identificational particularization? I'm really curious to see how this plays out in other books.
Sure. Another one the lecture mentions is the Song of Solomon.
The Song of Solomon, okay.
Right. And it starts off really simply, just the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's.
Okay, so right away we know it's a collection of songs. And they're probably love songs, right? Since it's Solomon.
Exactly. So that heading, it sets the tone for the whole book.
Yeah.
It tells us what to expect.
It's like picking up a novel and seeing romance or thriller printed on the cover, right? It helps you approach the book with the right mindset.
That's a great analogy. And it helps us avoid misinterpreting the author's intentions.
Yeah. Can you imagine reading a love song as if it were a theological treatise?
Yeah. Talk about a confusing experience. Okay, so we've got identificational particularization, where the author gives us a heading or a title to set the stage. What else is there?
Yeah, what other types of particularization are lurking out there?
Well, there's logical particularization.
Logical particularization. Okay, what's that all about?
So with logical particularization, the author starts with a general statement, you know, almost like a thesis statement, and then the rest of the book kind of unpacks and develops that idea.
So it's like the author saying, here's my main point, now let me explain.
Exactly, like the opening paragraph of an essay.
Right, where the author lays out their argument.
Yep, and the lecture actually argues that Proverbs 1.7 serves as this kind of general statement for the whole book of Proverbs.
Proverbs 1.7, hold on, let me look that up.
It's a good one.
Okay, it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction.
There you go.
Wow, that makes so much sense. So many of the Proverbs are about, you know, practical advice for daily living, but they all connect back to that idea of fearing the Lord and seeking wisdom.
Exactly. It's like a lens through which we should view all those individual Proverbs. They're not just random sayings, but pieces of a larger whole.
This reminds me of recurrence, you know?
That's it.
It seems like both recurrence and this logical particularization are ways of emphasizing key themes, but they do it a little differently.
That's a great observation. Recurrence is about repetition, using the same words or phrases to hammer home a point. But logical particularization is about starting with that general statement and then using the rest of the book to kind of flesh it out.
So they're both working together to make sure we get the main point.
Exactly. They're two sides of the same coin.
I love how these different structural techniques work together, like different instruments in an orchestra, you know, each one playing its part to create a beautiful, harmonious piece of music.
That's a great analogy. So we've covered identificational and logical particularization. What's next?
Yeah. What else do we need to know about this particularization thing?
Well, there's also historical particularization.
Historical particularization.
Yeah, this is where the author starts by describing a historical period, but they do it in general terms. And then they zoom in to specific details.
Ah, so it's like setting the stage before the actors come on.
Exactly. And the lecture points to Psalm 105 as a good example of this.
Psalm 105, okay.
So verse 5 says, "Remember the wonderful works that he has done, his miracles, and the judgments he uttered."
Okay, so that's like a general overview, a reminder of all the amazing things God has done.
Exactly. It's a call to remember, to look back, and see God's hand at work. But then the rest of the song goes into detail.
Details about what?
Well, it recounts specific events from Israel's history, like the exodus from Egypt, the wandering in the wilderness, the conquest of the promised land.
Ah, I see. So it's like a documentary that starts with a broad overview and then focuses on key moments to illustrate the larger story.
Exactly. That general statement sets the stage for those specifics. It gives them context and meaning.
So we see those events through the lens of God's faithfulness and power, recognizing them as part of his plan.
Exactly. And it works both ways. You know, when we read about those specific events, we should remember that general statement. It reminds us that those events aren't just isolated incidents, but part of God's ongoing story.
It's like seeing the individual trees within the larger forest, right? Each tree is unique, but they all contribute to the whole ecosystem.
Perfect analogy. And that ecosystem is God's grand narrative, unfolding across time and space.
Okay, so we've covered identificational, logical, and historical particularization. Anything else?
One more. Biographical particularization.
Biographical. All right, hit me with it.
So this is when the author starts by focusing on a larger group of people. And then they narrow the focus to one individual or a smaller subgroup.
Ah, okay. Like we talked about earlier with Genesis, right? How it goes from humanity in general to Abraham and his family.
Exactly. It's like the author saying, hey, out of all these people, pay attention to this guy. He's important.
Right. And that narrowing of focus shows us how significant Abraham's role is in God's plan.
Exactly. It's not just his personal story. It's about how he becomes the father of a nation, the ancestor of the Messiah.
The one through whom all the families of the earth will be blessed.
Yes. It's like the author is using a magnifying glass to zoom in on the key player, you know, the one whose life will have a ripple effect on history.
And those ripples extend all the way to us, right? The readers of this ancient text.
Powerful, isn't it? It reminds us that we're not just passive observers of these stories. We're participants in this grand narrative that's still unfolding today.
Wow. This has been an incredible journey. It feels like we've only just scratched the surface, but my mind is officially blown. It's like I've been given a new pair of glasses. You know, I can see things in the Bible more clearly now. I can appreciate the artistry behind every word.
I'm so glad to hear that. And remember, this is just the beginning. There's so much more to explore, so many more treasures waiting to be discovered. Keep digging, keep asking questions, keep letting those ancient texts speak to you in fresh ways.
I will. This deep dive has been amazing. I can't wait to apply all these insights to my own reading and study. Thanks for being such a fantastic guide.
It's been my pleasure. Happy exploring.